He was described in the Wall Street Journal as a premier futurist in national security environment, and he's consulted for the U.S. military, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the FBI. His book, Cybersecurity and Cyber War, What Everyone Needs to Know, is a New York Times bestseller that has been praised for its answers to some of the most important questions of the digital age. Joining me to set the stage here and kick things off with the summit, celebrated author and cybersecurity strategist, Peter Singer. Peter, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just jump right into it. What are some of the key threats and issues surrounding cybersecurity today?
Well, so you have that ancient saying, it was both a blessing and a curse. May you live in interesting times.
Right.
And that's really what we're seeing here today, both the good and the bad. So when we look at the threat side, for example, the size of the cybercrime market, it's costing somewhere between $400 to $500 billion. In turn, though, that's led to the security marketplace that by 2020 is going to be around $170 billion.
Wow.
So threat, opportunity. If we're looking at overall big trends, I'd break it into a couple of areas. You have the people side of what looms. And the way to think about this is everything from we have about half the world's population online. We have to go. Mm-hmm. With that brings not only more opportunity, more sort of the blessings of the digital age, but also a huge number of targets. And frankly, people, unlike you or I, who haven't spent the last 10 years experiencing cyber threats, so many of the low-level stuff that we might shrug off will hit them. The other side of the people issue to wrestle with is in the security marketplace. There's a people gap. There's just not enough talent to go around. The numbers in the U.S., there seems to be about a 200,000 labor gap worldwide, around a million. So again, problem for organizations, for companies, opportunity for people who are working, who have that talent. Organization side. We've seen growth here. We have over 100 different cyber military commands around the world, everything from the U.S., our cyber command, to Ecuador recently launched one of its own. Threat side, though, organization, we're seeing transnational criminal networks, of course, work together and fill that gray space between state and sort of individual hacker. And of course, many of them working on behalf of states and some operations and conflicts. And then finally, the tech side, when we look at what's changing, lots of exciting things that are out there. And we're at the hub of one of these right now.
Right.
So everything from, you know, wearables to Internet of Things.
Right.
But of course, what that does, besides all the wonderful opportunities, is it opens up the threat landscape. A lot more targets to hit.
Sure.
And it also raises the stakes. So when you're seeing things like car hacks, drone hacks, medical devices hacks, that means that more can be done. It's not just stealing information in terms of what looms.
Right. Now, you and I were talking moments ago about how all of this has evolved, and now there's major companies coming out saying, hack us, get our information. Who are the cyber criminals today? Are they entrepreneurs? Are they all up to no good? Are they hackers for hire? Who are the cyber criminals today?
So if you're looking at this, you know, marketplace, it's basically shifted from being individuals. Many of them were, you know, doing this either for fun or low level. A lot of them just doing it for attention, to it's become professionalized. It's become transnational. And when I say professionalized, we're also seeing specialization. We're seeing black marketplaces where we're seeing lots of trade going on between talent, between tools. So beyond just thinking about the who, I think what holds steady is the why. So they asked the bank robber, Willie Sutton, you know, why did you rob banks? And he said, well, that's where the money is.
Right.
And that's, you know, what we're seeing here. But if we're looking at what people are going after, they're going after things that are perceived of value within that company. So your own intellectual property that you know is of value, or financial information that you're holding that you know is of value out there. What we're also seeing, though, is going after targets that hold information that that entity may not think of as value, but it's valuable to someone else, so that third-party side. And that may be in regular old cybercrime. So I'm going after healthcare, but it's because of financial information that's within that network.
Gotcha.
But it may also be cyber criminals working on behalf of a state. So we've seen examples of that, of everything from healthcare to transportation, tourism companies being hit by foreign spy agencies. They may go after you for retaliation, retaliation for something that you did that was unpopular. or controversial, or it may be that you're just a target that's there for someone else. So your nation did something and they want to hit something in that nation and you're just open there. So lots of different reasons. The final thing that looms is when this moves into regular old conflict, traditional war. We're in a space where over 90% of military communications go over the civilian owned and operated internet. And so cyber criminals in some cases are being deployed on behalf of states as part of their, what we would describe as traditional military operations. So we've seen that in several conflicts recently in the Middle East, in Ukraine, for example, where commercial entities have been targeted by quasi-criminal networks as part of more of a political campaign. And in that, they're not trying to steal information. They're trying to shut down, reduce access.
Right. So it sounds like the answer then is that the modern cyber criminal is not out of central casting. There's no particular make or model. It could be somebody up to no good, somebody up to retaliation, or it could be more of a war.
Well, I mean, if we take, you know, from Hollywood, all of them would be wearing hoodies. And,
you know,
but the reality is they come in, you know, all sorts of shapes, sizes, ages. They're not all teenagers living in their parents' basement. Their location will be around the world. One of the more fascinating things that we've seen recently is actually the physical movement of cyber criminals. Like you and I, they move to areas that they see as hospitable. So one of the things that's changed recently is we've seen groups that were based out of Eastern Europe actually move to Southeast Asia. And the reason is sort of a combination of maybe they've been living in war zones that have taken off recently, or where there's been some kind of political change or higher law enforcement. So they're moving to somewhere else where it's a little bit more hospitable to their activities, or frankly, the weather is better. And yet what it's worrying, I was recently talking with a bank executive from Asia, is they know these groups have physically picked up and moved to Southeast Asia. So far, they haven't been going after Southeast Asian targets, but they're saying they're worried about the idea of sort of these guys walking down the street in their day-to-day and going, huh, actually, maybe I should be hitting this target instead.
Right. Wow. Scary stuff. I'm curious to get your take. What do you think of the White House's new cybersecurity plan?
I'm fairly supportive of it. I'm supportive of it because it's bringing action and attention that's, you know, long overdue. We've you know, had the wake-up call, is this abused, overused term. You know, which wake-up call was it? Was it the Opium breach? Was it Sony? I really don't like that term. But so, one, we're taking action. Two, if you look at what is in the proposal, it's fairly nonpartisan. You could see it coming out of either a Republican or a Democratic White House. And it's got some sort of expected government elements to it. It's raising the spending level by about $35 billion. It's putting research into some good areas. So, for example, changing, you know, how do we have more advanced passwords, things like that. It creates, you know, very classic governmental thing, creates a commission, a bipartisan commission. Those are sort of expected government elements to it. There's also some, I would argue, best business practices being brought over into government. That's good for government. It also points to what businesses should be doing. So, for example, it both creates and empowers a chief information security officer position. It creates a council across different government agencies of people who are working on privacy issues so that they can coordinate their policies and the like. It mandates regular audits of your vulnerabilities and figuring out what kind of valuable data that each of these agencies are holding. And going back to our previous part of the conversation, not just what you think is valuable, but what other entities may think is valuable. And so, you know, if you want to protect your crown jewels, you have to figure out what your crown jewels are. There's another element to it that I really like is the focus on the human side. So within government, we have a challenge. We have a number of open positions. So for example, the last data that I saw was at the FBI, about 40% of the cybersecurity positions were open. And that's the same at lots of other government agencies. And so what it does is create not just new positions, but incentives for people to fill those positions. And those incentives range from sort of direct things like higher pay to scholarship aid. And so I think it's a fairly good program. It's going to be interesting, though, the determinant of its success or failure is not going to be this year or next year. It's one of those things that the value of it won't express itself for about 5+ years.
Right.
So in many ways, it will be President Obama's cybersecurity legacy after he's left.
Sure, sure. Well, and speaking of filling positions, there will be a vacancy in the White House soon. What is your take?
Yes, we are in silly season.
The political landscape here. What's your take on how cybersecurity has been handled with the 2016 election so far?
There was a recent study at a university that described it as fairly disappointing, and I think I agree with that. And what we have is a voting public that considers cybersecurity incredibly important. It's one of these very interesting issues that connects so many different levels of concern. It matters to you on a personal level, the security of your bank account, your devices. It matters on an organizational side, whether it's your business or your government agency. It matters in terms of geopolitics and national security. It's very hard to find topics that link all of those levels together. Mm-hmm. So people care about it. And yet, if you look at the campaign trail, it's not really been dealt with in whether it's the debates or in the policy proposals that have been put out there. There's been a lot of controversy over kind of individual use of an email account, but not kind of what is your broader policy. And if some of the candidates don't even have proposals for what their policy should be, other candidates have them, but I describe them as they're sort of the lead harder, where they basically say, I'm going to do the same thing. I'm just going to lead better.
Right.
And that's disappointing, considering how important this topic is.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you talk about the threat at large of cyber terrorism? We've just talked about you never know where it's coming from. We're all at risk. Some of it is almost glamorized in the movies and TV shows. Like you said, is the guy with the hoodie who's fooling even the brightest minds. What is the legitimate
threat? If he could just type fast enough, he'll launch the attack that
that's
will destroy
right.
us all. Yeah.
But on a real level, what is the threat of cyber terrorism?
So I think we need to distinguish between the use of the internet by a terrorist versus cyber terrorism, according at least to the FBI definition of it. And the way I go through this is to think about two terrorists sending a letter to each other, a traditional letter.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't call that postal terrorism. A terrorist sending a letter bomb, we would. Same thing here, at least according to the FBI definition of it. It's not simply using the internet, it's using it in a way that causes physical violence, causes loss of life or injury. So we haven't yet seen that kind of cyber terrorism. We've seen terrorists use the internet in many of the same way that you or I would, whether it's to share information. ISIS arguably wouldn't exist or certainly not reach the level that it has without the use of the internet, particularly social media, to spread its message, to recruit. It's to collect information. We've even seen hacking by different groups. So to go back to the example of ISIS, it's carried out attacks, done things like break into networks and steal information, then dox it, post it online. This has been a little bit overblown in the media. Sometimes the information that's been posted online is things that you could have gathered off of a regular search engine. In another case, they cracked a social media feed. But then what did they do with it? They didn't, take down the power grid. No one died. They actually posted an image of a goat. Life went on. That's different than using it to carry out an attack that causes physical damage. So I'm not saying that won't happen. We've seen attempts at it. We've seen governments pull this off, not yet in terms of loss of life, but Stuxnet is an example. It was developed by, allegedly, the U.S. and our allies and used to sabotage Iranian nuclear research. It physically damaged the equipment. We've seen attempts to go after power grids and the like. So we could see this, but it's not as easy as it's portrayed in the movies, and sometimes even by government policymakers. A former Pentagon official talked about how all you needed was a couple of teenagers and some energy drinks.
Right.
No, if you use the example of Stuxnet that we developed, it involved expertise that ranged from some of the top hacking, so to speak, talent in the world, mm-hmm. to experts in everything from nuclear physics to engineering, working together over the course of not just days, but months and even years. Mm-hmm. And then it involved that in combination with sort of a James Bond style operation to get it into the target facility.
Right.
So it's not as easy as it's portrayed. So real risk, but not in terms of how the media and even some government policymakers would have it. Mm-hmm. If we're thinking about terrorist use, terrorist threat with the internet, it's more so on the information spread side of it. It's the part that gives terrorist actions, the actual terror, the mm-hmm. spreading of it. And I think right. we've seen that in incidents like Paris or San Bernardino, right. where that message, that horror goes across the network like a virus, not the actual computer virus impact
sure.
of it.
So the threat is very real. Execution of it, not maybe the way that Hollywood would lead us to believe. Let's find out what the audience thinks in regards to the poll question we threw out in the beginning on how legitimate they see all of this and do they fear an attack. I mean, we're going to pay off the results here. Remember that poll question we asked you to answer? Here we go. Do you think we'll see a cyber terror attack in the next year? Let's find out what our online audience says. Almost 90% of them say yes. How do you respond to that? Surprising or not surprising at all?
I think they're right in terms of, if we look at a cyber terror attack, we see attempts at it. We've seen examples of it, and the targets might be anything from military networks to more likely civilian networks. But if you added an adjective in terms of kind of catastrophic or one that results in a loss of life, then we'd be in a very different
right.
space. That's less likely, fortunately. But again, we're moving, particularly when you talk about the move to something like the Internet of Things, mm-hmm. you're more likely to be able to pull this off to cause physical damage. And so, but let's pull back on all of this.
Sure.
The first car bomb was actually back when we called cars horseless carriages. It was used in an assassination attempt against the Ottoman Sultan. And the Ottoman Empire doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Airline hijackings back in the 1930s. So yeah. despite the threat and the use of that kind of technology, be with cars, be with yeah. airplanes, we've still figured out how to use them in all the wonderful ways today. The same thing when it comes to the internet, when it comes to the digital world.
Now, we're talking, of course, about, cyber attacks and cyber terrorism. What about a cyber war? What does cyber war actually look like?
So here again, it's the term cyber war is abused as much as
sure.
The word war itself,
Okay.
War on sugar, war
right.
on poverty,
sure.
You used to describe lots of things that aren't real war. So if we're talking about war, we're talking about a political context when there's loss of life, mm-hmm. and that's what distinguishes it from regular old crime. Lots of different modalities that you might see in a conflict, particularly between states when it comes to the use of this technology. Mm-hmm. Some of it may be the collection of information passively. So we've already seen nation states, for example, gather information that's, online, being revealed by either soldiers or by civilians in areas to learn what's happening. Even you and I can figure this out. The bin Laden raid, mm-hmm. the most secretive special operations raid of our lifetime,
right.
was actually live tweeted by someone.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
So then you have active gathering of information, cracking into someone else's network, stealing their battle plans, developing personal profiles and the like. And what's interesting, I think, about this part of cyber war is some of it may actually take place before the actual war begins. So I crack into your networks to figure out, everything from the designs of your weapon systems to your personality as a general. Then you have not just stealing of information, but the blocking of information. We've seen that in the recent conflict in Ukraine, where units were in effect isolated. So military units, government agencies that depended on the internet to get orders from their commanders to know what's happening around them, basically block went up mm-hmm. and they didn't know. They were both physically but also virtually isolated. And many of them surrendered because they didn't know what else to do. And here again, this is an example where sort of the cyber war was arguably lost before the real war began. Then you have not blocking of information or stealing of information, but changing of information.
Right.
So a great example of this would be Operation Orchard. It was where Israel launched a airstrike on a Syrian nuclear research facility. It flew planes over Syrian air defenses, but simultaneous to that, through digital and electronic warfare means, they in effect turned off the Syrian air defense network. So the radar operators didn't know what was happening. They couldn't fire, they couldn't target their missiles. But then the warplanes dropped traditional bombs. So it's these things working in combination. Mm. And here again, things that we're seeing in war, we're also seeing on the crime side. So a similar example of this kind of combination would be recently there was a attack on a ship. Actually, a group of pirates seized the ship, traditional style, but they went in and they, instead of taking the whole ship and holding it ransom, they go into the ship and they find the specific box in the ship where hundreds of millions of dollars of diamonds were held. And they knew where to find the diamonds because they'd previously hacked the network.
Oh, wow.
So it's these things working in combination. Final thing was what we talked about before with Stuxnet, where you're actually changing the information to cause physical damage. And what's important here, again, is that went after industrial control systems that are using everything from nuclear research to Navy warship engine rooms to pretty much every major business has some kind of industrial control mm-hmm. system, even controlling things like, you know, their HVAC systems and the like.
Right. Well, and that provides a perfect segue to a recent survey. Americans said they were more afraid of cyber attacks than nuclear weapons. So what can businesses or the government do to alleviate some of these fears?
I think we need to change not just our, you know, actual posture and strategies, but also our mentality. We have to move away from thinking of this as just pure defense, keep the bad guys out, and deterrence. I'm going to scare the bad guys away so they will never attack me. To one of resilience. We have to accept the fact that as long as we're using this technology, bad things will happen. The bad guys will attack. The bad guys will get in. The bad guys may already be inside your networks. Mm-hmm. Insider threats make up about 1/3 of the overall threat landscape out there. Resilience is instead about figuring out, how am I going to power through the bad things? How am I going to get back up quickly when I've been knocked down? And that not only sort of takes the sting out of it, it also makes it less likely that you will be attacked. It takes the incentives away from the attacker side. The problem with the resilience model is that it, while it may be the most effective, it's not the most sexy. It's a lot easier to sell to you that I'm going to stop every bad thing from happening instead of saying, no, I'm going to help you through the bad times.
Right.
That resilience model is, I think, one of the most important things that we can do. And it needs to be built into everything from how companies organize themselves and prepare themselves and prepare their partners and clientele. And the same thing for how we message from government to the public to the role of media in this. You know, I think about the difference between our dialogue around cyber threats, and you see some of these, you know, cyber Pearl Harbor and the like, mm-hmm. versus the British mentality towards something we were talking about earlier, terrorism. Mm-hmm. Keep calm and carry on. Which one incentivizes attackers to come after you?
Right. Absolutely. Well, and obviously all of this, you know, is being led by wonderful technology. With the good comes the bad. But talk about the human side of cyber terrorism.
Well, whether you're talking about cyber terrorism or the broader array of threats out there, as well as your responses to them, the most important space is between keyboard and chair. Mm-hmm. It shapes everything from the decisions of what targets to go after and to what attacks you're going to use to, in turn, how well you will fare against those attacks. And understanding the human side. And when I talk about this, is not just the marketplaces that exist out there in terms of, say, the black marketplaces. It's also within your own organizations, within your own business. How are you incentivizing your leadership, your employees to deal with these mm-hmm. threats? Are you going through training exercises, not just in terms of sort of getting smart on the technology, but also figuring out how you might respond to certain scenarios? And again, this is not just something something within the IT department. Sure. It's across the organization. Often the determinant for particularly big corporations between a loss from a breach measured in hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars to tens or hundreds of millions of dollars is not how the IT department handled it. It's how everything from public affairs to the C-suite handled it. So that human side is critically important. It also goes back to something we were talking about before in terms of the human side of the overall talent. We have a human capital problem here. Mm-hmm. Basically, there's not enough talent to go around right now. That means we are bidding over great talent. It's a great time to be someone with the expertise in the field. Mm-hmm. It's a bad time to have them working for you because everyone else is trying to poach them. Sure. That points to the role of education and how we can, I think we should do a lot more public-private partnerships in mm-hmm. this space to try and widen the pipeline. There's also some diversity problems within this space. And that, again, is you can see that as an opportunity from kind of an engineering perspective. If there's not enough talent, how can I widen the pool? You can also see it from an equality standpoint. So there's just a lot of human elements to this that we need to work on. But again, they point to opportunities rather than just saying there's nothing that we can do.
We only have a minute left, but I want to get your take on the Internet of Things and the security implications there.
Huge issue, yeah. Huge.
Which I give you a minute to answer.
Pressure. I mean, sure. I think the challenge of it is not just the raw numbers, where we're going from about 6 billion to 50 billion things linked up to the internet, but it's that a lot of the companies moving into this space aren't baking security into it because they don't see themselves as technology or security companies, but they are right now. Mm-hmm. And that also applies to the government regulators who are dealing with them, whether we're talking about cars, to medical devices, you name it. Mm-hmm. We've always sort of been playing catch up, again, whether it was with cars or railroads to software. Now, as we talk about hardware, we don't have the timeline of catch up. We're not mm-hmm. going to have multiple decades to get this right. There's a compression space here. So when I think about the Internet of Things, I'm so excited by all the opportunities, but I also hope that we pay a little bit more attention to security than we did with past programs.
Peter Singer, thank you so much for your time, your expertise today. We appreciate it. All right, thanks for being here.